Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting to order, and we're going to start with a flag salute. All rise as able. Thank you so much. So today is August 14th, and this is our SLOCOG board meeting. And Clerk, could we please have the roll call?
Board Member Arnold.
I'm here.
Board Member Gibson.
Here.
Board Member Guthrie.
Here.
Board Member Moreno.
Here.
Board Member Ortiz Legg.
Here.
Board Member Pichon. Board Member Rushing.
Here.
Board Member Strong.
Here.
Board Member Waggy.
Here.
Board Member Wixom.
Here.
Vice President Paulding.
Here.
President Pease.
Here.
Ex officio Veronica Lissama.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. So one update to our agenda is that Director Pete Rogers is not feeling well today and so will not be here. So the closed session on the employee review is going to be postponed until September. Okay. This meeting will be followed, though, after we close it. We will have the RTA Executive Committee meeting for those who are part of the Executive Committee, and those are always open to the public, and they'll be right here in the same chambers, I believe. Yes. Terrific. Okay. So we are going to go to public comments. These are for items that are not on the agenda. As you, anytime throughout this meeting, if you come up for a public comment, you'll have 3 minutes to speak. You are requested but not required to state your name for the record. And I have Eric Greening and, let's see, I think these are both for items not on the agenda. Eric Greening followed by Christine Sieber, and then Rita Burton. And those are the three speaker slips I have at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and obviously there's quite a wide variance in the political spectrum, but a common concern with either energy and or climate. Do we have enough energy or are we harming the climate? And depending where one is on the political spectrum, either sacrifices of environmental quality are accepted as the price of extracting or producing energy, or sacrifice of people's lifestyles are expected in the way of healing, by way of healing the climate. In the background of all this is a monstrous threat we need to much more consciously confront. And that is something we have always lived without just fine. And it is now being aggressively intruded into our lives. Politicians across the political spectrum are demanding and advocating major taxpayer investment in it. It's AI, artificial intelligence. Its appetite for energy is voracious. So bringing it home to the Council of Governments, my question is, do we know to what extent AI is intruding into any of our intelligent transportation systems or other functions of this as a body or of the transportation programs it funds? If so, can we do an inventory and can we find ways to prevent, to not depend on this source, that this new element that is both increasing the massive appetite for energy and in so doing threatening the climate? We could build solar panels to the horizon, windmills everywhere, and not heal the climate one iota, because every particle of energy produced would go not into displacing the more emissive sources, but into feeding this growing beast And so I'm not sure exactly how we can go about it. It might be worth seeing if there are other COGs anywhere that have undertaken such an inventory and or such a resistance. But if we can't join an existing resistance, I think we need to start one, because AI will basically turn all the goals across the political spectrum relative to energy, relative to climate, into useless dust if it is allowed to continue aggressively intruding into our lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Christine Sieber, and followed by Rita Burton, if you could be ready to speak. Thank you. And if you're next to speak, please come forward so you're ready to come to the podium. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christine Sieber, and I'm here today to save lives, human and animal alike. My name is Chris Sieber. I'm a retired educator of 33 years and a Cambrian of 23 years. In the spring of 2022, I contacted the Caltrans District 5 and worked with Catherine R. to request more accurate deer signage. By the fall of 2022, I am grateful to say that we had 6 new more deer signs, as well as I asked for deer signs and have solar lit signs and speed limit lowered. They were not granted at that time. I am here hoping you will reconsider the solar lights and the speed limits through the short 4-mile stretch of Cambria. I have many Cambrians in support of this. Cambria is a travel destination with an abundance of wildlife. Many are not aware of the deer crossing on Highway 1. Cambria is a wildlife corridor. AB 43 allows counties to lower speed limits for safety. The speed through our 4-mile stretch, the speed should be lowered to a safer stopping distance at 40 miles per hour with solar lights highlighting for deer safety. Odds of being killed by a wild animal are 1 in 4 million. Odds of hitting a deer in California are 1 in 2,700. Odds are much higher through Cambria. Deer is the deadliest animal in America. 440 human deaths in California in deer accidents and 59,000 injuries with thousands of total vehicles. At 60 miles an hour in good conditions, you have a stopping distance of 268 feet. At 40 miles per hour in good conditions, you have a stopping distance of 139 feet. Lives are at stake. In the fall months of October through December, they are more likely to hit a deer. Factors line up for a perfect storm in Cambria. Number one, rutting season, mating season, deer running, chasing does through the highway. Number two, daylight savings time. Deer strikes go up by 16% during daylight savings time. In a full moon is the most time people would hit a deer. Christmas market in Cambria sells 3,000 tickets per night. Number five, low visibility and dust. Number six, 64% of deer accidents happening between 6 and 9 p.m. Let's not let a family coming into the Christmas market hit Rudolph or Bambi. I am not asking for $427,000 Caltrans spent in 2022 for deer jump outs on the Quest to Grade. I am not asking for $92 million of animal crossing, like the largest animal crossing in the world down in Thousand Oaks at Highway 101. I am asking for a safer 4-mile stretch of Cambria. We need drivers to drive at slower speed and slow down and be alert and aware. Let's stop playing Russian roulette through beautiful Cambria. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. And we have Rita Burton. Thank you. And that's my final speaker slip if anybody else has a public comment today.
Good morning. My name is Rita Burton, Cambria resident. This is the second time this year that I have addressed the council on behalf of the Cambrian community and its ongoing concerns regarding Highway 1, its deer strikes, and auto accidents. The 4 to 5 mile highway through Cambria Forest is at times a busy and dangerous thoroughfare. Recently, on a Sunday afternoon, May 19th, a 20-year-old driver crossed the yellow line at Burton Drive and Highway 1, killing herself, maiming her passenger, and plowing head-on into a Bakersfield couple. There was no wildlife or alcohol involved. Motorists drive too fast and are often quite easily distracted. As a relevant aside, recently two bears were killed and two were maimed in Yosemite National Park. The speed limit is now reduced to 25 miles an hour. The most distressing thing for Cambrians is when, on occasion, the deer are not killed outright, but flounder around in abject pain with their fawns looking on helplessly. Meanwhile, the injured animal awaits its fate, which is often too slow in arriving. There are too many variations of animal strikes to cite here, although a young mountain lion was killed last month. Apart from auto accidents, there are too many close shaves with trucks and automobiles not involving wildlife. Therefore, on behalf of my fellow Cambrians, I respectfully request the speed limit be reduced to 40 miles per hour for the 4 to 5 mile corridor through the Cambria Forest. This is a short stretch of highway and will not cause a hardship to motorists. As Cambria is in a remote area with limited sheriff and CHP presence, perhaps the most effective means of controlling speedsters is the installation of speed cameras. Just for the record, I would like to state that this is not a project that I chose to undertake. It was Caltrans' own employees who approached me stating, quote, "You are a person who gets things done. Can you please do something to reduce the amount of dead wildlife on Highway 1 that we have to pick up?" Unquote. So here I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments. We're going to proceed. This is not an agendized item, but as we go to the director's reports, if either of you want to comment on any of these items, you're welcome to. We are going to start with the SLOCOG director. Sorry, Teasleg.
Yeah, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to take a minute here because I do think that the speakers spoke to a couple of things that, again, we can, you know, if they want to, if our Caltrans partners want to respond, but I want to respond to the issue of speed and the notable increase of vehicular speed in particular that is just going on. And we see it with our tourists. We see it with our local residents as well. And I think that we all have to be very mindful. And I just, I want to just take a moment of silence to recognize one of my constituents, Saul Goldberg, who was struck a few weeks ago on his bicycle on South Higuera. And again, speed was evident in this, distraction, all of that. So if we could, I'd just like to, in memory of Saul and in hopes of trying to be mindful and for us to be using our voices about slowing down. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Appreciate that. All right. Let's go to director's reports. We'll start with Rich Murphy.
Thank you and good morning. Oh, how about that? Yep. Better? Better, better. Just a quick comment with respect to the public comments that did come in. As you know, SLOCOG is in the throes of developing a regional safety action plan, and we're collecting and compiling a great deal of data associated with some of the most challenging areas in the county, both on-system and off-system. So we are collaborating with Caltrans on all issues safety, and we appreciate the feedback that came in with respect to the public comments this morning on that. So we'll talk with John DeNunzio, make certain that those kinds of conversations continue and get integrated into our planning efforts. As you also may know, with the bipartisan infrastructure law, there is new funding available since that bill was passed for safety improvements. So our intention is to develop an action plan and develop priorities and pursue funding as we're able, again, in partnership with Caltrans. So that said, yes, sitting in for Pete this morning, I did want to give a quick little shout out. I didn't expect to be here like this, but this is my granddaughter. She turns one today, so I'm going to keep her in my lapel. And I'm still sort of grappling with what Supervisor Gibson said to me in the crosswalk, and that's all right. I'll get through that. This isn't what I wished for, by the way.
I didn't know.
Very good. So on the first slide here with new grants received, and the continuation of the conversation of safety, $120,000 from the Office of Traffic Safety, continuing some of our walking audit efforts in the unincorporated areas of the county. $300,000 grant received from Department of Housing, I believe. Correct? No? Caltrans, thank you very much. And so I will be, you'll see me leaning on staff a little bit more than Pete does. So if you, hopefully that doesn't distract. But this is the next step in our transportation efficiency analysis work, where we'll be looking into maximizing the return of our investment in housing. And then, of course, last week, Mr. Straw had the opportunity to host Congressman Carbajal at the transit layover facility, or the transit facility, maintenance facility. And that was a great event, but $2.5 million additional resources brought in for RTA federal funding for the continued electrification of their fleet. Going on to the next slide, just a quick statement on the state budget. A very popular program, the Active Transportation Program, is unfortunately been cut back considerably for this next cycle. We don't. Our expectation is on cycle 8 and beyond, we'll be back into a more robust funding program, but the state's competitive cycle 7 is a bit restricted, with only $168 million available statewide, where in cycle 6, it's been in the neighborhood of $1 billion, which included an infusion of some local, of general fund monies. But it's typically about a $500 million program. And then the good news is that we did, with respect to the state budget, the REAP funding, that where we had funded projects in Grover Beach and the city of San Luis Obispo, where we expected some cuts as part of the state budget. Those cuts were reduced significantly from a 50% cut to about a 6% cut. So our agency is getting back some of our discretionary resources where we were plugging the holes, trying to be proactive. So $1.4 million will come back to us for programming at a future date. And continuing through Pete's report here, the Rural Road Safety Awareness happened in mid-July. There's a slide there. There's Safety Sam. That's Caltrans' little friend, right? And that was that's John DeNunzio, who's running the safety Regional Safety Action Plan effort and coordinated this. It was a very good event, and thank you for those that participated. And I'll just hop down to number 5. You can pass on the Blues because I missed that game. I know Jeff Straw is disappointed being that he's a baseball guy. The Curbrail Activity Hub, Multimodal Activity Hub. Is that what we're calling them now, activity hubs? Very good, $500,000 project. There was some concern that we lost some of the funding with the state, and the Caltrans has effectively fully funded that improvement in Atascadero. This is a mobility hub, park
Sorry.
And ride lot.
Mr. Murphy, I just wanted to see, yeah. Is that aligning with the slide?
No, that is not.
Thank you.
Go back one slide, I'm sorry. Oh, it does. He doesn't have a slide for that. And the construction is expected to begin in late 2024, and they'll have some EV chargers there. And on staff training, we've been very active in wanting to understand all of our strengths in the office and how to best maximize our internal teams and working together. And we've had a great effort. Thank you, Mallory, for orchestrating that, and Ashley. And we will continue to do this. We have new staff coming starting in September. We'll ask her to do the same strengths training so we understand where she is best suited and can work collaboratively with all of us in the office. So that's been a great awareness session for all of us. The secretary, you can go to the next one, Stacy. Secretary Housefa Kaka from the governor's senior advisor on homelessness will be in town August 26th. We're facilitating the stakeholders to get together and discuss issues of homelessness in the county. So that will, if you haven't received an invitation to some of those discussions, look for those. Rail grant, if you could go to the next slide, has been submitted to the state, where the Central Coast has partnered together to bring $30 million of local match resources. This is, as you recall, one-time funding that was made available through the governor's budget, SB 125, and in the legislature. So through Monterey County, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo, we are trying to leverage a $70 million grant with the state for sidings and rail switches. To the next slide, on August 22nd, we will be hosting the Losan folks, and that'll be a reception here in San Luis Obispo out at the train station, and it'll be an opportunity to get a sense of the new rail maintenance yard that's going to be constructed here in the near term. So that's a great event that's being hosted by us and supported by our local partners. And then lastly, you can just pass that one. These are, unless Lance, you'd like to come up and talk about all these slides. Okay, very good. So the information's in your report, and then I'm sure we'll have a thorough update on the event, maybe in October or December, and get more details on some of the information I just passed there. And with respect to our ongoing coordination, of course, that's imperative to us working effectively together in the region, and those are some of the meetings and coordination sessions that we maintain continued engagement in. And then lastly, other statewide, before we go to that one, other statewide upcoming meetings is the California Transportation Commission meets this week in San Diego. Pete will not be making that, and I'll be heading south. County of San Luis Obispo is seeking an extension on their right-of-way funding for the Bob Jones Trail. At that particular meeting, the September, which is recommended for approval, the Coastal Commission will be in the area in October, or actually they'll be in San Diego. It says here September 11th in your notes in the agenda, but the meeting will be in October, where they will discuss the coastal development permit for the U.S. 101 managed lane, and there are some conditions of approval that we're still working through with them. With respect to the Shell Beach Road shared use path. And September 26th, there will be a town hall transportation commission meeting, and I'm not certain why that's where that is, quite honestly. It's not in our region, I can assure you of that. Is it in Monterey?
I believe so.
Okay, well, there you go. In the mega region. Yes. In the mega region. And that is Pete's update. He did note some notable, I think that last slide, Stacey, had reference notable items on the consent calendar, and he wanted to bring attention to the first one that's not on there that we could just add is item C6, where we had a grant camp over the summer, over the week of July 8th through 12th, and we had 28 campers. I think they all got merit badges, perhaps. There are recordings on the website, and as you know, there are, with the federal bill program, there are a number of federal grants that are out there, and many of the transportation practitioners, we're all still trying to figure these grant programs out. And so it's really helpful to have folks from the state and federal agencies participate in this program. This is the second year we've done it. We've received some good feedback. And Garrett, our intern, Garrett Hauk, is that how you pronounce your last name? Hauk, okay, very good. Thank you for all that you did to make that a successful week. We have coming up on B5, just notably that it's rideshare week and there'll be free public transit the week of October 7th through the 11th, just to better understand. Is that correct? Did I make that statement correct? It's free public transit that week? If approved. C4 is putting out an RFP for the senior WAV. It's our senior services, and we're just trying to get a better handle on our cost control efforts with respect to those services. And then the performance audit, C5, if there's any questions on it, we're happy to have Ashley and from our staff offer any answers that you may have.
Great. Thank you so much. All right. Any questions on from the board on the executive director's report? I do have a speaker slip, but I'm going to do both of the director reports and then allow public comment on this item on the agenda. Thank you. Okay.
Great. Yes, thanks. Good morning, Chair, directors, and members of the public. Veronica Lizam on behalf of Caltrans District Director Scott Eads. A couple of items to present this morning for you. First, we're excited to announce that Caltrans has awarded over $51 million to 89 projects across the state for various transportation planning studies. As Rich mentioned, SLOCOG was awarded about $300,000 for a planning study, which they will be kicking off later this year. Throughout the district, there were seven agencies that received over $7.2 million in funding for these efforts. Secondly, we also wanted to extend an appreciation to Mr. John DeNunzio and his staff for providing us with the opportunity to participate in the grant camp. This provided us with the forum to provide the SLOCOG member agencies with information on various funding opportunities that are offered throughout the state. So thank you for that opportunity. And to address the member of the public in their comments, thank you for your feedback. We have initiated preliminary conversations with SLOCOG staff in regards to some of the Cambria wildlife crossing issues. We've discussed the opportunity of possibly applying for some funding in the next year. In the meantime, we'll probably be coordinating to identify a scope of work for that. So more to come on that. But thank you for your comments.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions on that report? All right. Seeing none, we do have one request for comment. Eric Greening.
Thank you, Eric Greening. Since one of the items on the executive director's report had to do with road safety issues specific to the unincorporated areas, but I wanted to basically affirm support. I'm not familiar with the situation in Cambria, but I can tell you, as someone who has been hit by a car in an incorporated city, speed is violence. I was very fortunate. It was someone driving into the rising sun and apparently not seeing, but I was hearing the vegetation kind of being clipped. So I was actually leaping out of the way and fortunately received only a glancing blow rather than a frontal smash. So most of the damage was simply from spinning in the air and falling on a slope. But I can tell you, this probably wasn't more than 30 or 35 miles an hour. It was violent. And so people in vehicles that are moving at that speed and faster speeds need to be aware that they are potentially dispensing violence every second they are at the wheel, and that any added increment of speed, it adds to the damage at a geometrical rate. The rate of increase of damage with speed is not just linear with the speed. And so the question I'm going to ask, I guess, is what I saw relative to the executive director's report dealt with assessing the safety in the unincorporated areas. Is there anything comparable happening in the incorporated cities where a lot of the accidents do take place? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Appreciate those comments. Did you have a follow-up, Mr. Murphy?
Do we have... we would just direct you to the SLOCOG's Road to Zero website to respond to Eric's question on that.
So... Great. So the Road to Zero was an opportunity to identify specific spots that are concerning in terms of traffic safety?
Yes.
Is that that's still up and live, correct? Great. Thank you. Terrific
board
resource.
Comment?
Yes, Mr. Strong.
Yes, thank you. One of the things I think is that's important is for everybody, whether it's the driver or the bicyclist or the pedestrian, to actually be aware of their surroundings too. I had a near miss just the other day when a bicyclist ran through a stop sign, didn't stop, making a left turn and cutting the corner just as I was approaching that stop sign. And he barely missed me. And who would have been at fault? Who knows? Usually the car is found at fault regardless. So be careful, everybody, not just drivers. Everybody, please be careful.
Thank you. Sarah, do you have a comment now? Or you're getting ready for the next thing? Okay, just making sure. So that's concluding the director's reports. I would like to just reiterate the invitation for the August 23rd, 22nd, that Thursday evening or late afternoon. The Coast Rail Coordinating Council has our regular meeting on Friday, but on Thursday we're hosting the tour of the new Losan facility, and there'll be a reception at the Railroad Museum, and it's just a delightful time, and a lot of people are going to be there. So if you'd like to get a little bit of a tour of that space, that'd be terrific. All right, we're going to go on to the consent agenda. Are there any items that the board would like to either comment on or pull for discussion? Okay, I'm not seeing any. I did have one comment. I don't need to pull it, but I am looking at the item B3, the rideshare report, which is delightful as always. And a lot of great things going on in there in terms of the slow car free. I'd love to see the outreach on that kind of travel, as well as the bike lockers. And I'm wondering if we could get a brief update from staff just to fill in terms of kind of what are the high impact programs, perhaps, and are there any hidden gems that you think could be really effective but aren't yet? Maybe we can, as a board, help get the word out, and then maybe the opposite, if there are some that are really time intensive and maybe aren't yielding the kinds of results. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for that. Mallory Jenkins, Slow Cog staff. Appreciate the opportunity and the comments as well. So this is our biannual report that we present biannually. Just trying to present the highlights on the report. Bike Month was a really big success for us this year. We had over 60 events, lots of schools participating in Bike to School Day. As always, that's a really feel-good program for us. I know you mentioned the Bike Locker program. That's a new one that we've started. And previously was quite time intensive. So now we have a new on-demand system that we're working with a third-party vendor to implement and pilot. So far we have two locations, one in the city of San Luis Obispo, one over at Cal Poly, and we do have funding for other locations as well. So we'd be really interested if you have other areas throughout the county that you'd like to see some of these bike lockers implemented. Our Know How to Go program continues to really try to increase outreach to seniors and people with disabilities, give them more information about all of their transportation options. Doing outreach to commuters, schools, I think our Safe Routes to School program is another one that continues to just see a lot of need. We did our family survey at the beginning of the year, during the springtime, where we collect feedback from K through 12 families about what their concerns are. And I think just kind of echoing some of the concerns that we've heard here, we continue to also hear that speed and amount of traffic and safety at crossings is a big issue. So I appreciate that. And happy to take any questions.
Terrific. Thank you. T's leg.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I'm glad you brought this up, Madam Chair, because the county, our public health department, has been engaging in regards to commuter support as we're taking away parking lots for our Welcome Home Village. One of the things that we did was get in touch with SLOCOG, and they have been marvelous. And I think some of the data that came back from our staff was that we don't have enough bike racks. There was a whole bunch of things that we learned, and I just want to salute you and thank you for assisting with us for finding solutions. And many of the employees noted that, yeah, I would be interested in saving money on gas and jumping into a van pool. So I think we've got some opportunities here, and I hope other businesses continue to remember this resource. And I just want to say thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Terrific. All right, so seeing no other questions, we do have one public comment on consent, item C3, Eric Greening.
Thank you, Eric Greening. And at the Social Services Transportation Advisory Committee, the report on the rideshare also got a lot of compliments, very effective programs. C3 has to do with the electrical vehicle infrastructure. And I just wanted to call everyone's attention that, you know, there's a big push to vastly increase the charging infrastructure, more locations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If the pollutant that came out of it was visible, if it was orange goop and it was spreading all over and into the soil, people would be alarmed. But since it is invisible, and since local governments have had their ability to exercise any health-oriented scrutiny erased by Section 704 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which needs to be repealed, a lot of people are not aware that they are some of the most, these charging stations are some of the most electromagnetically emissive hotspots around. Obviously, the damage is greatest to the people who are using them, but they can also affect their neighborhoods. And I think it's good to be aware of that, even if you're supposedly constrained from doing anything about it. A good website to visit for an inventory of various electromagnetic hotspots and their consequences is Safe Tech International. A good book to read is Invisible Rainbow. And the author of Invisible Rainbow actually has another website, the Cellular Phone Task Force. But since cell phones aren't particularly slow-cog business, I won't go there. But charging stations are. And the demand from above that we have millions of them in this state to accommodate the scam that vehicle electrification is going to heal the climate is itself a major source of pollution to human beings and to other creatures, pollinators, and especially harmful to the electromagnetically sensitive. So please at least be aware of this. Maybe if you can, go slow. Don't grab every dime to put out every, especially when they're in proximity to sensitive receptors, which are all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moreno.
Yeah, and I think this might be for Ms. Jenkins. I wasn't going to bring this up until it became a subject conversation. I wanted to find the graph. When I'm looking at the family survey, I mean, the top three of why you don't have your kids bike or walk to school is speed, intersection safety, and amount of traffic. And is that something where we look and say, there are viable measures to mitigate those concerns? I think a lot of us do that. We probably walked a long ways to get to a school bus stop and traffic and all of that. And is it simply we just have different factors in play now? Is parenting a little different? Were people a little more protective of their kids? And no matter how many factors we put into place, people aren't going to have their kids walking and biking to school. Do we have a sense of that, of what we can actually control here in terms of the outcome?
Sure. Yeah, I can try to speak to that a little bit. I think, you know, for us, our side of the program is a non-infrastructure side of the program. So we're primarily doing education, outreach, encouragement type programs. So there's that side of it. There's also the infrastructure side of it and the enforcement side of it. So it's really kind of a combination of all of those things working together and trying to, do what we can to make sure that people are feeling comfortable walking and biking, not having, close calls, things like that. Yeah. We work with our Safe Routes to School Task Force. We meet biannually. Anyone's welcome to attend that meeting. So we have some concerned parents at that meeting. We have CHP sometimes at that meeting. We have folks from active transportation in your jurisdictions at that meeting. And we talk about all these issues and try to collectively come up with plans to solve them. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, it is kind of both of those things working together. We can't do the encouragement piece without the safe infrastructure piece and vice versa.
Great, great points and discussion. Mr. Paulding.
Thank you, Chair. Just one follow-up question before, Mallory, before you take off. I know that at one point we were talking about the prioritization tool that SLOCOG uses to identify safe routes projects throughout the jurisdictions. And I know school readiness was one of the factors. I see that Central Coast New Tech stepped up and started doing a little bit more in the way of outreach. And that's one of the boxes you have to check to kind of be more eligible for funding on the infrastructure side. Now, what is the status of that prioritization tool update?
Yeah, so it is part of our overall work program for this year. So that is something that we'll be working on updating and working with the task force.
Okay, so the goal would be to have it updated and completed by?
The goal would be to have it completed and updated before the end of the fiscal year for sure. I think, you know, we want to start that here in the near term. We've also got our on-bike education program that we are working with Bike Slow County to figure out what schools we can accomplish the on-bike education program at over the next 2 years. And we do think we'll have a little bit of flexibility to get some of those high schools involved as well.
So that would be great. Thank you so much. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Great. And I think we're ready to entertain a motion for the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Paulding and Gibson. And could we have a roll call, please?
Vice President Paulding?
Yes.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Arnold?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Ortiz Legg?
Yes.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Strong?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Wexham?
Yes.
President Peace?
Yes.
The motion passed.
Great. Thank you so much. All right, we will go to our public hearing items. F1 is the Vehicle Miles Traveled Mitigation Program draft study.
Thank you, President Pease and Board. I was just really excited to talk about VMT, so I was just up here so early, so apologies for that. So I'm joined virtually today by Michael Schmidt of Kimley Horn. So this is our first time using this audio visual since the update, so hopefully it goes well. If not, we'll figure it out. And item F1 is the Vehicle Miles Traveled VMT Mitigation Program Draft Study. In 2022, SLOCOG and APCD received a Caltrans Sustainable Transportation Planning Grant to study a regional program and create an avenue to fund local VMT reducing projects. All 8 of the jurisdictions provided a letter of support for this effort, and both planning and public works departments are represented on our steering committee. So VMT is now the metric we use to study transportation impacts in the California Environmental Quality Act. Before 2020, we used level of service, which measures delay, and now we measure distance through VMT. This VMT mitigation program is not related to the vehicle road usage charge pilot program or private vehicle roadway charges. Our scope is CEQA-related transportation impacts. The intent of a regional mitigation program is to provide development with another option if transportation impacts occur. The order of operations would be on-site improvements or within the community. If those options are not enough or not available, a regional program could provide another avenue rather than a statement of overriding consideration or the project not being built. Now I'm going to hand this over to Mike Schmidt, our Kimley Horn project manager and VMT mitigation expert. So let's see how this goes.
sharing my screen. Is it showing up?
Yes.
Great. Good morning, Chair and Board. So in the next few minutes, these are the topics I'm going to cover. I'm going to start off by first just revisiting the project purpose. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the history and background of SB 743, which is the basis of this project. I'll talk a little bit about how we currently mitigate vehicle miles traveled. And then I'm going to move on to talking about the program options, which was the focus of the study, as well as the mitigation project or measures, which are the underlying solutions to reduce VMT that could be funded through such a program. And then we'll talk about the next steps. So the study purpose was to study the feasibility of a framework for a regional VMT mitigation program for the San Luis Obispo region. Now, there's a couple of important notes. I'm just going to restate what Sarah already shared, that the study is in response to state law. So it's not something that was an action that was taken on by SLOCOG. It's truly just related to SB 743 and trying to respond to the needs of VMT mitigation. It's focused on providing mitigation for projects that have no other mitigation options. So again, as Sarah said, there's an order of operations, this being the final solution opportunity to mitigate. And if you don't have a significant transportation impact, you wouldn't have to participate in this. So this is just only for projects that are seeking feasible mitigation to address their CEQA needs. So just a review of SB 743, which is, again, the underlying law that is mandates this analysis and need for this is it's a state mandate for all jurisdictions across California. And again, SB 743 is CEQA specific. It's the basis for making a transportation significant impact. So when you go through the checklist, this is one of the important basis for that. And really, SB 743 sought to promote sustainability and greenhouse gas reductions by promoting denser infill development, reducing single occupancy vehicles, and improving mass transit. The most recent guidance, on which many jurisdictions have based their guidelines or thresholds, were produced by the Governor's Office of Planning and Research in 2018. And it recommends that each individual land use get split out and analyzed separately. And then again, EMT is the principal metric, which most folks have heard or are familiar with now. So at the onset of the projects, one of the things we did was just to establish the need for future VMT mitigation. So we used SLOCOG's travel demand model to essentially do a forecast. So this is devoid of anything that on site someone may do to mitigate any individual project. But this is just trying to establish the kind of higher level need for VMT mitigation. And you can see what this shows us is if the land uses that were implemented per the SLOCOG model came to pass, there would be significant VMT each year that would need to potentially be mitigated. And much of this, we understand, would not probably be able to be mitigated through just some of the measures I'm going to talk about in a moment. And you can see, you know, we've got as much as 20,000 VMT per year, employment as much as 13,000. And I want to make the point that that's above the threshold. So that's not just the amount of VMT, it's the amount that would need to potentially mitigate. And it's a worst case scenario. So how do we mitigate today? Well, you know, one of the primary tools we have in our toolbox is really land use. And the way we can do that is we try to get the jobs and housing balance correct. So we try to get, you know, the things that you need or services you need closer to your home, and we try to make that right land use decisions. Other things like infill retail or infill land uses, those are also ways to solve that. But one of the primary tools we have in our current mitigation toolbox to address mitigation is really transportation demand measures. And these are either policies or actions that really just kind of reduce trips. And these include things, many of these are employer-oriented, I should point out, you know, and includes things like van pools, guaranteed ride homes, flexible work schedules, first-last mile solutions, and alternate modes incentives, so maybe, you know, free bus passes or things like that to get folks out of their vehicles. These work well for employers, they're more challenging to implement if you think about a residential thing, and they're also more challenging the further out from very urbanized areas. So that's kind of left a lot of projects, and this isn't exclusive to this region, but across the state, without enough tools or options to find ways to mitigate the impacts related to projects. And so VMT banking and exchanges we're talking about today have become one of those areas that we're starting to research and look to as a solution. So At the onset of the project, SLOCOG led the preparation of the existing conditions report, which is just kind of a state of what's going on with SB 743 in the region. And the findings were basically that agencies are in different stages of having adopted SB 743 and implementing them. And, you know, and if I were to take another region in California, that's kind of a consistent finding. Many local jurisdictions are in different places and still dealing with this requirement. Several agencies actually within the region haven't had a project come forward that needs VMT mitigation, which is an interesting finding. Agencies with projects are finding limited success with transportation demand measures, as I stated before, so that wasn't a surprising finding. And they're looking for opportunities to find other ways to mitigate those impacts for projects. And several agencies, as part of the project, we made a call for projects and said, well, what opportunities do you have? What VMT reducing ideas do you have that we can potentially fold into such a program? And so some of those were shared at the onset. So I'm going to kind of take you through an example of how would this program potentially work. So I'm just going to kind of start with a hypothetical situation. So we're going to start out with this hypothetical project. And I'm kind of showing you from the context of one single residence, but you got to imagine this is like a residential project that has 100 homes just for our purposes. But the idea is the way we measure VMT currently is we kind of take the homes and we consider the potential trips over the course of the day. So folks make trips to school, drop off their children perhaps, shopping trips, trips to work. We total up those trips over the course of the day. When we come out with a per capita per person VMT, and you can see in this example, it's 16.5. We've also established a threshold and we say, okay, well, that leads us to being 1.5 over. In this example, this leads to an absolute increase of 450 VMT. So they need to mitigate 450 VMT. So it kind of moving on with it. Well, you know, if I kind of like show this bar graph kind of thing. So the initial project analysis has an impact. It's kind of shown here. And we move on to doing site stuff. So if we kind of, there were some, maybe they, as part of the project, they had constructed an active transportation link to the regional network or something. But often, you know, particularly in these like a suburban or rural residential projects, they're still left with some amount of impact. And so the idea is this VMT bank or exchange or some variation of a fee-based program could potentially get them to the point where they don't longer have a significant impact and they've effectively mitigated their VMT impact. So I'm going to give you an example of how a VMT bank works. And this, what I'm showing you now is kind of the preliminarily is the recommendation for how a program may be formulated in the region. Basically, the idea is we take VMT reducing projects. So if you imagine a transit project or a bike project, or active transportation, including pedestrian projects, or even something like parking technology. We often spend a lot of time just driving around trying to find parking spaces, so directing folks more clearly to their spaces can reduce it. But we figure out how much VMT this group of projects can collectively reduce. And in this example, you can see we have 1,000. The total cost of those projects is $1 million in our hypothetical bank, and that comes to a unit price of 1,000 VMT. So the idea is that residential project then could say, I'm going to purchase VMT credits to offset the remainder of my impact. So that's the idea behind it. As part of the efforts undertaken as part of the study, we evaluated several different programmatic solutions like the bank. You know, we arrived at the bank, although we're still looking at some variations based on comments from the jurisdictions. We also looked at an exchange, an impact fee, several different options. Some of those had concerns. Some of those related to legal concerns or other complexities in terms of implementation. The bank was felt to be the most simple and straightforward. All of these programs, I should point out, are feasible, just having varying levels of complexity. The thought was perhaps that a bank may make the most sense initially if that's the desire to go forward with. Although in the future, other programs could be considered as variations. So after we've established this program, we need some solutions, mitigation solutions to go under it. So that's where we undertook this further call for projects from the agencies and said, you know, what projects do we have out there that are VMT reducing that could be potentially funded through this approach? And so I've just kind of got here an anecdotal review. Some of this is based on our experience across the state working on it, just to give you a sense of how various projects are in terms of their cost effectiveness. Because one of the things that is kind of unavoidable when you're talking about VMT mitigation is how much do I have to spend on a particular type of project to reduce some unit of VMT? So this just gives you a sense anecdotally of that. You know, like bike projects, you know, especially ones that are more simple can be more effective. Mobility hubs, often multipliers of the effect on multiple modes of transportation that are non-single occupancy vehicle coming together, van pools, carpools, you know. Pedestrian projects tend to be more difficult because they don't replace a lot of auto trips, which is really the purpose of a VMT reducing project. So we looked at, this just gives you a sense, we looked at a broad range of projects and asked for, you know, when we had the call of projects from the jurisdictions, which I think we got just over 20. From those 20 projects, we basically whittled it down to about 6 projects. And these were mostly selected based on the idea. You know, we had some criteria, but it was also selected based on what projects were cost effective, were easily implementable. And then we were also thinking in the context of this perhaps could be the basis for a voluntary pilot program that may be the logical first step of the program, although we're still waiting for input on what that might look like. But that's the idea behind this. But again, there are several other types of projects that are almost waiting in the wings for a second or third phase, potentially, if there's a desire to move forward this program. And I should just point out, you can see that the costs are there. The daily VMT reduction was estimated for each of the one. And then we had a unit pricing, which if you look down at the bottom, we came out with a $1,170 per VMT reduction. We also established criteria for ranking these VMT mitigation measures in the future, as if the program were to take off and were to become a scale up. You know, obviously, as I showed at the onset, there was the potential for this meeting the needs of a lot of VMT mitigation if there was that desire. And so these are the measures that were kind of established if there was as a framework for further conversations when more mitigation measures were being considered at the same time. They look at things such as the cost effectiveness, the reliability of other funding sources, because we can bring other funding sources to bear. This doesn't have to be the sole funding source to implement various mitigation measures. Very concerned about things like immediacy, the timeliness of putting these projects in the ground. The geographic distribution was obviously a concern as well. We want to make sure that we're not just concentrating measures in one particular jurisdiction, because with DMT, it doesn't have to be mitigated right next to where that project may be occurring. It could be mitigated tens of miles away easily. We also were concerned about making sure we met the needs of transportation disadvantaged populations, and also that these mitigation measures promote the plans and programs that are already. So we developed this criteria. This could help guide future decision-making if there's a desire to scale the project up. So in terms of next steps, we're refining the draft study to address comments. We're actually waiting for the jurisdictions to provide their final comments by tomorrow. We're also working on some case studies where we would take groups of land uses in different contexts across the region and essentially analyze those to give a flavor of exactly how much would this cost kind of for a typical residential project, say in a suburban area, or you know how it may affect a rural project on a different type of land use. We've got another steering committee meeting to discuss the results of the update. We're also producing some informational videos. There's also a quick response tool that's gone with this, is to facilitate analysis for the jurisdictions of EMT projects. That's being finalized. And then the intent is there'll be a final draft of the report in September, with the board taking this issue up again in October. That's the final slide I have, so I'll pause. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Yes. So with that, we would love for some comments so we could prep that for October and make them all available in that final draft.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate having Kimberly Horn, Mike Schmidt, join us for that and be available. So we will go ahead and take questions and comments. We don't have any public comments at this time queued up. So, Mr. Waggy? No, yes, thank you.
Yes, Mike. sound like this is limited to a county, not to a region. For example, we cannot partner with Santa Barbara County. Is that correct?
You know, there's the potential for that in the future. You know, there's all these. This is a relatively new type of program, to be fair. And so, you know, most at scale, most folks are looking at just at the MPO level or a regional level. There haven't been a lot of cross-regional conversations, but there has been some conversation about even that maybe in the future Caltrans may undertake a statewide approach. But there's nothing legally preventing that. It's just probably more of a logistical challenge. It's just, as I said, we're in early days of these types of programs.
Because it sounds like it's a greenhouse gas reduction, so it can be anywhere in the state theoretically. It just seems like in a rural county, it's going to be hard to perhaps find those kinds of projects to put in the bank.
I think that's a fair point, but I also think, you know, one piece of constant feedback, and we're involved with several of these throughout the state, is that, you know, there is always concern about the dollars that are going from mitigation going so far away that they don't feel like they're being spent in the community they were collected.
Sure. So, obviously, if we try to do something in Los Angeles, that would probably be frowned upon. Okay, I'm just curious what the scope of it was. And obviously, it sounds like the bank is probably the most feasible, but I'd be interested to hear other comments.
Thank you. Ms. Ortiz-Legg, then Mr. Paulding, and then Mr. Strong.
Thank you. I'm really glad to see all of the process that's been put in place to date. I think that the part that, you know, we struggle with here is that along the 101 corridor where we have in areas outside of our metropolitan areas, I will use San Miguel or Shandon as an example. Those are the places where affordable housing can be built, but because of VMT cost, it becomes unaffordable. And then we can't get the population then to have the mass transit services because we don't have the population, as well as the type of workforce. So I guess that, you know, where we'd like to see the linkage is that for us in a rural county to be able to build in areas that are along the corridor but can benefit from transportation aspects. So somehow that linkage I don't feel is connected. It does. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's kind of what my first response is to this, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Paulding.
Yeah, I have similar concerns, and I guess just jumping specifically to the VMT mitigation bank concept, Mike, we have a community betterments program that this board has authorized and that we try to fund on an annual basis. It's sometimes in jeopardy of funding based on limitations. However, it's been a pretty successful program, and I think the original idea was we were putting about $750,000 per year into safe routes and seeing the benefits, seeing the eight jurisdictions be able to deploy those projects and said, well, why don't we put a little bit more in? And we've seen, I think $8 million was the last amount. Why wouldn't we be able to continue to leverage community betterments, which is a regional program, as the implementing mechanism for the fund that obviously developers would pay into when their project is approved?
So good question. You know, it's worth kind of revisiting the fact that this is CEQA specific. So this program is specifically to address VMT impacts. So any projects that were funded through it would have to have that nexus, essentially, that they're reducing vehicle miles travel, and the amount being reduced is commensurate with the impact of an individual project. There's also some legal complexity in the fact there's a concept called additionality, which basically says if something is already funded or is already programmed, we can't defund it and then use this as a funding source. So this kind of has to be what I describe as it has to happen because of this money. It's kind of an additional thing that wouldn't have happened in the time frame or a project that wouldn't have happened if it were not for this source.
Yeah, and I remember studying the nexus and proportionality case law, the Nolan and Dolan decisions when I was in law school, and trying to understand, you know, the development impact fee nexus, and each of our jurisdictions have studies that establish that correlation. And this concept of additionality is a new one to me. And I guess it just what you're saying is that I fully don't understand it, I'll be honest. So I'll look forward to comments from the board on this. But looking at kind of whether we could leverage programs that are existing at the slow cost level. I see what you're saying. There has to be a nexus to the actual project and the benefit associated with the improvement. But if we had a program that established with ratios or with some type of data that would drive that process, it would seem we could perhaps leverage existing programs as opposed to creating new with the mitigation bank concept. Anyway, that's my comments at this time. Thanks.
All right, now we're getting in the thick of it. Mr. Strong and then Mr. Gibson.
Yes, and mine is going to be mostly a comment. Actually, I have a problem with the overall situation here. This was supposed to be turned off. I'm sorry. I turned it off twice. But I don't know what's going on. Here. Turn it off totally. No, turn it off totally.
You got it?
I hope so.
I'll try.
Okay. I'm sorry. This doesn't look from the 20,000-foot view. And that involves a number of other areas that we separately study. This is narrowed to a very, very small area. National League of Cities has now adopted a position that safety trumps VMT. Now, that's not a state view, but that's a national view. And as they move forward with their transportation program, that's going to be one of their considerations. And I think it has to be ours as well as VMT. One thing this does not look at is Caltrans currently is trying to stop at-grade crossings on highways. And they've done a partial mitigation at Airport Road and Highway 46 as an example. But they haven't done the full thing quite yet. However, even that, if that full thing gets into effect, it will increase the travel up to the airport industrial area by approximately 5 miles per vehicle. 5 years from now, we will have 6,000 commuters going into that area in the new industries that are being proposed for that area right now. That would be 6,000, well, not 6,000 cars because they'll probably carpool. Let's say 3,000, let's say half, 3,000 cars traveling an additional 5 miles, 10 miles each, 5 miles each direction, extra, in order to get there because they're going to have to go all the way up to Jardine, come all the way back around, et cetera, as an example. Other alternative routes are even longer, unless we put in the bridge over Highway 46, which has to be done within the next 2 years to be effective because that is approximately going to be 5 years from now this is all going to happen, and it takes 3 years to build the bridge. And there's two bridges involved to complete the project. So 3 years of construction time. So that hasn't been considered. Also, the fact that we have spent approximately $2 billion to stop the designation of Blood Alley from Highway 46 East. And we have succeeded in doing that by dividing the highway thus far. We haven't quite completed it. We have one more small stretch to go, but we're working on that as well. And we're working very closely with Caltrans to accomplish that. And that's excellent. But it's not done. And if we do this and don't build that bridge, and we have those at-grade crossings in order to get over there, we're going to increase that back up to even higher than what it was. And that will reestablish our wonderful designation of Blood Alley for our area, which we do not want to have happen, I don't think. So I think we have to take a more of a 20,000-foot view of this and analyze all the different factors that are going into it, including future land uses, future projected economic development, the fact that we have a spaceport license pending up in that area, which is due to be granted within 5 years, which is when all of this is going to happen. I think we have to take a slightly different look at some of this. And I'm not sure if Kimberly Horn was giving all of this data. So I don't know how much of this data went into the report at all.
Mike, can you go over some of the information that you went through to put into the Tread Light tool and also when you're coming up with the projected VMT that might be produced because of development?
Yeah, no, great question. So, you know, what we rely on is the forecasts that were generated. You know, the MPO obviously takes the information that it gets from the local jurisdictions and develops a land use forecast, and that's produced in the travel demand model that you're all familiar with. We basically use that tool to assess the existing condition and then the future condition as well. And so we look at the, you know, the traffic analysis zone, which is the smallest unit of spatial geography within these models. We make determinations as to how are they going to relate to a threshold of significance. So again, we're talking strictly CEQA, we're having this conversation. And so we've assessed that across the whole region and made estimates based on current land use plans, as SLOCOG understands them, as to what those amounts of VMT will be. And then we've looked at the thresholds and said, how much VMT is over that? So, you know, I mean, great comments, you know, about safety, and those are important considerations too, but we were more narrow trying to address this fundamental question about CEQA and the needs as per the state law requirements.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As with anything new, there are some, I'm not usually in the means of quoting then Vice President Cheney about known unknowns and unknown unknowns, but there's a number of complications here. I mean, additionality to me seems pretty straightforward. That's, in other words, has been called non-supplantation. If you're doing something and you're spending a certain amount of money on it and a new source of funding becomes available, you are not to plug that in and divert the previous funds over. That shows up in a lot of different places, road maintenance and places. So I think it's pretty straightforward to work with that by defining a maintenance of effort requirement, and we go from there. I think there are a number of other fundamental issues, maybe they're 20,000-foot issues, that we are only asked to mitigate the impacts above the current average doesn't really get to what the impacts are. You know, if we're adding population, we're adding VMT, presumably we're adding impact. And I want to get to that from a CEQA perspective here in a minute. But it's clear that if we're only asked to mitigate above the average, we're not mitigating the entirety of adding new VMT. So, you know, this has been, in my view, shaded to be implementable and not necessarily completely effective, which are two different things. It seems to me that the question, I agree that I think per this analysis, the establishment of a VMT bank is probably the only practicable solution to move forward. That the efficacy of a VMT bank is really tied to our ability to do regional solutions. If you think about it, the whole purpose of that bank is to be able to do something over here when your impact is over there. And so that leads me to a question about what the actual environmental impact, this is probably a CEQA wonk kind of question, and maybe Mr. Schmidt has an idea on this. But if you look at typical environmental impacts as analyzed under CEQA, the destruction of habitat is a quantifiable thing that makes a distinct effect on the environment. The addition of noise to the environment can be quantified. The reduction of a water supply and the further stress on a groundwater basin can be quantified. But it's not at all clear to me exactly what the environmental impact of the existence of one more VMT is. I assume that it's eventually tied back to greenhouse gas emissions. And if it is explicitly so, then I think a broad regional context of mitigating greenhouse gas anywhere in the state is permissible. But until that can really be elucidated here so that we're comfortable doing that, then I think we still have some questions about the legal and the procedural underpinnings that really are going to make this work. And again, Mr. Schmidt, if there is a direct regulatory connection through CEQA to GHG or some other thing that is the actual environmental impact of of one more vehicle mile traveled, I'd be interested to know that.
Great question. I won't claim to be a CEQA lawyer, but I will speak to it within my understanding. The reason that VMT was selected was, you know, one of the primary underpinnings is greenhouse gas emissions, because there's a high correlation between vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas emissions. That's been shown over and over. And so basically that's an important underpinning, but the SB 743, the state law, also seeks to do things like promote infill development, reduce vehicle or reduce single occupancy vehicles, and promote transit. So it's got those important additional things. So almost like some quality of life things.
If I could, Mr. Schmidt, that, you know, those again, from a CEQA perspective, yes, those are all good things and all good social things, but what are they aimed at? They're aimed at, and I want to phrase it as a question, if they're aimed at greenhouse gas reduction, that's great. If they're aimed at reducing the amount of asphalt that we have to put on the surface of the earth, you know, those seem to be the salient questions as regards how we craft the use of a VMT bank funding source. And the geographic scope over which we can spend those monies and be doing what we're intending to do. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I get it that we want more transit, we want infill development, but infill development in itself is only a means to serving some policy goal, I would think.
Right. And I should just kind of take a step back, you know. So this was an important change to the requirements for a significant transportation impact under CEQA. So previously, we're all familiar with level of service.
Right.
Well, that's no longer allowed to be the measure for making that determination. So this VMT metric has basically stepped in to replace that. So it's kind of become the basis for making a determination, really, as to whether a project, whether it be transportation or land use, whether it has a significant impact. So it's really this change to this new threshold, this new basis. But you're right, foundationally, it's in these other questions. But the next chapter, if I kind of flip through in CEQA book, you know, it is greenhouse gases. It kind of follows on VMT, and VMT is obviously an input, but GHG has its own separate CEQA chapter. So we're kind of, I realize a lot of folks find this as a dissatisfactory measure, but it's kind of the one we've been kind of stuck with because it to meet the state's requirements.
Right. And using LOS, level of service, was obviously adding to greenhouse gas emissions, because you build more highways, you encourage more traffic, you encourage more VMTs, you get back to greenhouse gas. You're right. I mean, this is among the many imperfections, is that VMT is sort of semi-overlapping with the CEQA's GHG requirements. But to me, to be able to succeed, we need the broadest flexibility at the local level to implement these things, because we're stuck implementing these things. And so if we can say, look, our VMT bank at whatever level it's funded is about greenhouse gas reduction, that pretty much simplifies our life and makes it more manageable from an administrative point here, within the region, and gives us a much broader. We can go and let's do it over in Santa Barbara County, and we can save Santa Barbara County from being horrible GHG emitters. So, you know, that's my thought on this.
Thank you. And I'm going to insert my own comments, and then we'll circle back to you, Mr. Strong, if that's all right, and folks will be able to continue to build on this. I'm really appreciating the conversation about getting to the crux of the concerns. A couple of questions. Mr. Schmidt, in terms of the cost per VMT based on staying within the county and the projects that we have available to us, can you talk about how it seems kind of potentially pretty expensive? And to Ms. Ortiz Legg's point is, if we're trying to get housing and this becomes a barrier rather than helping us solve a greater problem. So is the cost of trying to keep it just with these county projects, how does this compare to other communities that are considering banking kinds of systems? This was, you know, over $1,000 per VMT. Is that typical for, like, would a more urban environment or some other environment, does that kind of seem like a reasonable cost, or is that pretty high?
Well, that's kind of a tough one to answer really simply, because, you know, part of whether it's high or low really depends on what I'm trying to mitigate. So if I'm trying to mitigate something that's in a very rural context, that's very far out, and I need a lot of VMT, well, at $1,000, it's going to be a very high price tag. If I'm in a very urban area, that I would need less VMT, so it's less. If I'm just talking about relatively, you know, the $1,000 as a metric kind of thing, I'd say it's in the range of what we see in other places kind of thing. I've seen ones that are lower, but that gets to project selection. you know, picking projects that are very efficient. And then there's also is the opportunity, which we didn't fully explore as part of this project, but I would think is an important opportunity, is this does not, again, have to be the only funding source. You can have projects that have gap funding, in essence, you know, that they need some additional monies to be brought forward. And if this money makes the difference between that project happening and not happening, this project could still take the full credit for the VMT. So even if I'm only paying 20% of the price of this VMT reducing opportunity, I could take 100% of the VMT reduction. So there are mechanisms over time to make this even increasingly more efficient. It just is going to, one of the things we noted in the review of projects as we were going through it, is it may take a slightly different mindset when the programming of projects, if this was to be a primary funding source. So there's some need for kind of giving more consideration to how that could play out. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I do appreciate that. And then my second question is just kind of that, again, theoretical, trying to understand the flexibility or the options for a jurisdiction. So a project comes forward, the CEQA notes the significant impact, they're not able to mitigate it on site. We obviously have a process to find a statement of overriding considerations as it is. And so when I think about if a developer comes and they're trying to mitigate, but we've got this, you know, this bank, and with if we adopt the bank kind of option and come up with some kind of a balance where we end up with some contribution to the bank, but also statements of overriding consideration, is that still an option? And kind of, and then my follow-up or corollary with that is, how have you engaged the developer community to see how useful this bank would be for them in being able to deliver a project?
Right. So to your first question, you know, yeah, absolutely. You know, CEQA just basically requires that we provide feasible mitigation. So at some point, the price of mitigation in itself makes mitigation feasible. So there could easily be the potential where somebody may participate to some level. It's deemed financially not feasible for them to continue. And that's the entirety of their participation. And then they do seek that overriding consideration. You know, there also could be some examples where projects could be fully mitigated. It probably just depends on their location and the price of VMT. And then to your question about the how we reached out to development, we did have a meeting with the developers, a group of developers, and did solicit their feedback. You know, I could let Sarah kind of elaborate on that.
Yeah. Great, so thanks. We presented to HBA. They gave us a lot of good feedback on how this would work. And then Mike brought up some other examples on how development communities are using this, and it's making it easier for them to move projects forward. And then we went over the tool with them, and so they gave us good feedback on how we should be adjusting the format of that. So,
terrific. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Strong, and then back to Ms. Ortiz.
Yes, thank you. And some very good points already made, and some things I didn't mention that are also involved. Let's say that Caltrans actually now reopens these and allows the cross traffic to occur. In that case, if you have a cautious drivers, they're not going to enter traffic, obviously. They have to take a gap. That means congestion, because they're going to back up and they're going to sit there idling till they can wait to safely get across the highway. That idling will produce more pollution than vehicle miles traveled. And I don't know if there's any way to calculate that if what we're looking at is how to reduce pollution. So that's a factor. The other thing that's involved is our legislative program comes into effect, because through our legislative program, we can get amendments to the current criteria that take into account some of these factors. And that's something perhaps we should look at as well, in addition to this. I'm not saying not do this, but I'm saying there are many other factors we have to consider as we look at our overall programs, what grants to go after, when to go after them, when to issue the funding. And that's basically what I'm saying. I've been very supportive of projects all over the county. I have no objection to these projects. I just can't take a position against projects that are going to affect the lives and health of my local constituents at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Moreno.
Mr. Schmidt, could you speak briefly to how something like a bank would be put together? Would it be forming of a JPA amongst the varying municipalities? What is the cost and effort associated with doing something like this?
That's a great question. You know, I think those agencies are kind of moving ahead, and I'm involved with, I'll say, Santa Cruz is also exploring the they're kind of a little ahead work than this program, and we're working on looking at establishing a JPA, to your point, because I think similar to like an impact fee program, just a traditional impact fee program, JPAs often serve well to have, you know, agreement at the table in terms of project prioritization, setting rules and standards that everyone can agree to. So I think this is probably at scale, fully implemented. I think that probably makes a lot of sense. And the cost would be no different than forming other JPAs. But obviously it's kind of difficult to predict because there's all legal MOUs and all kinds of other things that have to happen. I would say that there is also the opportunity, and I think that maybe one of the recommendations of the study is, if the first step may make sense, is to have a voluntary pilot program. So, and maybe that, you know, I don't want to put SLOCOG on the spot, but perhaps a SLOCOG or another agency could just manage this smaller version as a test case to make sure that, you know, it was meeting the expectations of the board and others in terms of its operations, and just run a smaller group of projects to kind of see if this is something that the board wants to pursue. But again, there's more than one option that's available to
you. Okay. Yeah, I'm curious about how much do we actually see being brought into the bank, and then, you know, the cost to, I mean, because we can look at some of the JPAs that we have, whether it's integrated waste management, APCD, there's significant administrative cost that goes with that. So I don't know what the answer is, but I'm wondering how many developments out there wouldn't end up with an overriding consideration and be paying into this. And is there, would there be a sufficient amount to actually make this viable and do what we're trying to make it do? Anyway, you probably can't answer that, but just things that I'm thinking about.
Those are great questions. And so we'll bring that back in October. So we'll start working on some of the cost estimations and stuff.
Thank you. Mr. Waage.
Yes, just for clarification, we cannot use greenhouse gas offsets for VMT. Is that correct?
That's correct.
No, different programs. And on the subject of who should do it, yeah, I think, I hate to add more to Pete's portfolio, but if it's within the remit of SLOCOG, it seemed like have an existing organization, if we could fund it somehow through the portion of the fees or portion of the offsets, I don't know. It just seems like if we use an existing program rather than trying to add to it, it might be more efficient. And I agree with Bruce, too. I think this is, it's a work in progress, so I think we're trying to feel our way, and until we can get some more clarity, it's going to be a little difficult. It sounds like there's really no models right now we can use. Is that correct, Mike?
Mike, I think since I spoke to the board last time, there's been three that have come online. Has it changed now?
There's a couple city examples. At scale is where it starts to become a question, I think. Yeah. Because like, there are examples of cities, you know, Palmdale, Lancaster, and there's a couple other cities that have smaller programs already established, up and running, and they're collecting fees. I think that what we talk about at scale, which is what we're talking about here, is regional examples. There's pilots at CCTA that's going to be rolled out. I think Metro is on the verge of rolling its pilot out. As I said, Santa Cruz is moving towards a pilot, and then obviously you guys are where you're at kind of thing. And I'm trying to think if there's any others, but this is one of those things that like, there's a lot going on suddenly with it kind of, you know, it's kind of like SB 743 kind of after folks got through the process of kind of figuring out, well, how do we analyze this? What are the opportunities for mitigation available to us? There was kind of this realization across the state is we need a broader range of solutions. And so lots of jurisdictions are kind of moving into this and studying it all at once.
Well, if we get the legislation changed to allow greenhouse gas offsets, that'd make it a lot simpler. So just a comment. Thank you.
Yeah, good point. All right. So this is a review and comment item. I think we've provided lots of feedback. I'm hearing, you know, like, let's keep going and understand this a little bit better. I do certainly look forward to feedback about kind of the cost to establish and run this kind of program and how to streamline that to be effective and to make sure that we would get the utilization to make sure that it would be worthwhile. whether or not that involves a pilot program, I think is right in there. But it does seem like there's still promise of a tool in our toolbox for those projects where it could be useful, but we'll continue to study that. So, all right. And I don't have any public comments on this one. So appreciate Sarah and Mike being part of that.
Thank you.
We are going to go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and then we'll reconvene for items F2 and F3 and finishing out. Thank you. Perfect. All right. Thank you so much. We are back from break, and we're going to go ahead proceed with item F2, which is the fund cycle program amendment, and Mr. Murphy will start us off on that.
Rich Murphy, programming staff at SLOCOG. As you recall, we discussed back in May the status of our major project grants and their efforts to secure state SB1 funding. And in that discussion, it was an information item, and we outlined in the North County and the North Coast some of those major projects that have some SLOCOG committed funding associated with them, some of the larger grants that are already committed to some of them, and some of the local resources that are committed to them. And we identified what is expected in the way of the grant requests at that time. With respect to the North County and the North Coast, we are going to get into the details of that subregion in October. So today, as we discuss Amendment number one to the 2024 fund cycle, we're going to focus our conversation on the Central and South County, of which this same table was also presented back in late May. And we highlighted to you then some of the shortfalls and information that we've received since we funded and completed our 2024 funding program. And we discussed also in May the status of the U.S. 101 Prado Road interchange overcrossing and its project readiness with respect to the grant funding programs through the state to pursue SB1 monies, and that they just were not ready to go in cycle four, which the guidelines will be approved by the Transportation Commission, California Transportation Commission, this week. The NOFO will be released, but the City of San Luis Obispo won't be pursuing that particular grant program in cycle four, of which our hands then become tied, is what we discussed last meeting, that the guidelines require us to not park, if I may use that term, our contribution within the State Transportation Improvement Program, the state CIP, on a project that doesn't have a trajectory towards pursuing a fully funded project at this time. Doesn't mean that the city won't be ready in cycle five. So we discussed it with respect to the time continuum of project delivery. So this being the Central and South County, that same short list of projects is on this, are identified on this map. Working our way down from 1 through 7, this being a transportation network, which was discussed both in the U.S. 101 corridor plan that spoke of a multimodal faceted solution to the U.S. 101 San Luis Obispo to Five Cities area, as well as the alternative route off of 227 and some of the improvements and investments that we've made over the course of several funding program cycles. And what you're seeing here in this slide is the total project cost top to bottom for these seven truly all priorities to advance to construction. And the question is, I just outlined that number seven, Prado Road, is not ready. So that $110 million interchange project is not necessarily, even though it serves an important role in projects 1 through 6, it's not ready right now in terms of its advancement for funding. So keeping that in mind and just having a look at those same seven projects, those first six, the total project cost, and looking at SLOCOG's total investment here under column A. So when we approved this 2024 fund cycle in March, SLOCOG's commitment was 30% for these six infrastructure projects, and accounting for $45 million. On May 29th, we identified in the information item that the $151 million total project cost has gone up to $165 million based on new information received from the project partners, the County of San Luis Obispo, and Caltrans. That said, as we discuss column C, amendment number one today, you see that as we go through the remaining need to advance this entire package of corridor improvements, the Avila Beach Drive roundabout, it's in construction. It's a fully funded project. What you see here in the 101 managed lane from Avila to Pismo, that segment that was funded through SB1 Cycle 3 is going to be ready to list in October of this year. We're hearing some good news, but we're not ready to really speak much to it, other than there could be some cost savings associated with the US 101 managed lane through the SB1 grant. It won't necessarily benefit SLOCOG's discretionary side, but that could have a trickle-down effect, all things considered, to the remaining needs as we keep going down this list. The Bob Jones project, the trail from San Luis Obispo to Avila Beach, there is a discussion next week with the supervisors on August 20th. There is some right-of-way pending matters on it, but the amendment recommendations that's in this package today addresses the difference between column A of $20.9 million to $27.9 million. So what we're showing here is a project feature within this Central and South County region as a fully funded project based on the recommendation in today's agenda packet. Also, with respect to the active transportation feature of this whole sub-region, the Shell Beach Road Shared Use Path Phase 2 and Phase 3, the cost, as you can see, when we discussed this back in April or back in March and approved it, at $4 and $5 million respectively, has gone up considerably with the additional information that has been received, we discussed last month or in May the inflationary factors and some of the bid or the items associated with the estimate as it went from 35% up to about 65% design. We're still working through much of that, but we have a more certainty of magnitude of cost for phase two and phase three. The recommendations in today's staff report still identify a shortfall of $4.1 million and $1.1 million respectively. We believe that shortfall can be chased, not with SLOCOG discretionary resources, but through the state's SB1 grant program. I mentioned earlier that the 101 managed lane may have some cost savings, and we're working through that to have that trickle-down effect address the Phase 2 project. The congressional project funding that is called community project funding through Congressman Carbajal is currently in the House Appropriations, and for the adoption of the federal budget for 2025 does identify $2.6 million in resources towards projects 4 and 5 on Shell Beach Road. And then we feel that continued conversations with the city of Pismo Beach to bring in some local resources, that this gap is not insurmountable. We can close the 5.2, but without additional SLOCOG resources. And then that said, the last component, the alt route, and we didn't really get into a lot of this last time, but it being an important feature, going back to that map, as we all know, the back way into the five cities, we had already initiated the Edna Trail investments, as well as in addition to some Carbajal funding there and commitment to the Los Ranchos Road interchange, which is in green. But that, again, no more SLOCOG discretionary resources will be recommended by us in the future funding cycles, even though what you're seeing here is an $8.9 million project corridor gap. We feel strongly that the investments that have been made by SLOCOG towards Los Ranchos and Edna will leverage other grant programs to close that gap. So that said, you can see over the time frame from March 2024 to now, we have gone from a $45 million commitment of money to a $61 million commitment. It should be, yes, $61 million commitment. And that has gone from 30% to 37% of the total package of projects. And then to just demonstrate the conversation back on Prado, which is the donor of how we are closing the gap on Bob Jones and contributing some additional resources on the Shell Beach Road shared use path. When they come back in the next fund cycle, we fully anticipate that through the Resolution 24 attached to this agenda item that we will be developing programming policies in 2025 that speaks to the value and importance of Prado Road, and that we would that this board would strive to maintain its 10% commitment to that project cost. So this may feel a bit of a silo and not discussing North County, North Coast right now, but much of the same discussion and language will come forward in October. We don't feel that these recommendations put any of the prior commitments made in the North County at risk in any way, shape, or form. And I say that in part because as you, well, we'll get to that in a moment. This is just some important dates moving through the timeline here of SLOCOG and the county, August 14th, our action, the County Board of Supervisors discussion on the Bob Jones component of all of these projects, and then a Coastal Commission action with respect to a coastal development permit and how it affects the Shell Beach Road project, which we're fully anticipating that the condition is going to be about having a fully funded Phase 3 project or a commitment of funding. And you saw how we were closing that gap in the prior slide. And then there's some time extension requests that need to be navigated through the State of California's Transportation Commission. And all this will move us through what we think will get us to projects that are ready to list out there in June of 2025 for the shared Shell Beach Road shared use path, Phase 2, which is Avila Beach Drive to Spyglass. The Bob Jones ready to list in March of 2026 is our goal, working with the county by having a fully funded project by today's action, and then having the Shell Beach Road shared use path ready to list in June of 2026. And you can see on the bottom there that the US 101 managed lane project is ready to list in October. So we see that we've worked through this project development process as best as we have been able with the limited resources that we've had, and we still feel that we're going to have the success of delivering those 1 through 6 in a timely manner, and then revisit our process and approach with the City of San Luis Obispo in the next funding program. we spoke last time about some of the questions that need to be asked and answered. Is SLOCOG able to set aside revenue and the resources for the City of San Luis Obispo as it relates to Prado? No, we can't set it aside, but we are going to develop policy for the 2026 fund cycle. Will the Transportation Commission support our recommendation to reprogram the Prado Road money? The answer is yes. And will time extensions be needed, and will they support it? That is still sort of a question mark, but we have a vote of confidence from staff that they will support the added time extensions needed, since this is demonstrating a full commitment of funding for the project in its entirety, speaking specifically to Bob Jones Trail. And then are there near-term needs more pressing in the region? Well, of course, there are near-term needs all over the place. In terms of this set of projects advancing in the Central and South County, there are no other priorities that are more pressing at this point in time. And then on the question of, well, just to give you a sense of some form of comfort that in terms of, well, are we really going to have resources in the 2026 fund cycle? The 2024 fund cycle, we programmed $44 million. You can see that through the through 2028, 29. In the 2026 fund cycle, as we just do some very preliminary estimates, we're expecting about $36 million at our disposal to work with our needs at that time. So Exhibit A in resolution, in the attached resolution, gets into a little bit more of the details of how we're doing the deprogramming of the Prado Road overcrossing RTIP funds and how that is trickling through those six projects. And happy to discuss any details with respect to this agenda item as you wish. In October, we will come and discuss this section of the North County and some of the changes and amendment issues that we need to address there, as well as on the coast with respect to the Moa Beta Cayucas Connect project. And all that being said, we've had unanimous support from our technical advisory committee on this. Our CTAC group concurred with one no vote, and we had our staff recommendation, which is Exhibit A in the resolution.
Great. Thank you so much. We do have some speaker slips on this one, but first, are there any questions from the board? All right, seeing none, we have Peggy Mandeville, followed by Will Benedict, followed by Leah Brooks. You have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Peggy Mandeville, and I'm a retired transportation planner from the city of San Luis Obispo, and I'm here today to show my support for the Bob Jones Trail funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Will Benedict.
Okay. My name is William Benedict. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo. I'm here in my capacity as a San Luis Obispo Bicycle Club board member, representing our over 600 members that live throughout San Luis Obispo County. Our mission has been to promote legal bicycle riding for recreation transportation for years. I know we've made presentation to you about this before and continue to work in this area. Key to this is advocating for infrastructure improvements that support safe cycling, which gets us the direction we're talking about today. We have supported the Bob Jones Trail from its inception and advocate for its completion. The San Luis Bicycle Club's commitment to the Bob Jones Trail is reflected in our significant contribution toward building the calf barn, which will be the trailhead. The calf barn is finished and ready to serve the trail. We need the trail. Specifically, the San Luis Bicycle Club supports the $7 million supplemental funding as a good investment because the Bob Jones Trail is a valuable, unique, well-used element of our bicycle infrastructure that attracts residents and visitors of all ages. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Leah Brooks, followed by Rick Ellison, then Eric Greening.
Good morning, Chair Pease and board members. I am Leah Brooks, representing Friends of the Bob Jones Trail, which enthusiastically supports the staff's recommendation to allocate $7 million to cover a budget shortfall for the trail connection. Friends is a nonprofit formed in 2013 to promote completion of the trail that will fulfill the region's decades-long vision for connecting South County to San Luis Obispo. I've been before you many times, and thanks SLOCOG for its longtime support. Public safety should be your top priority. Thousands of county residents and visitors will use this route for commuting and recreating because they want to feel safe. A counter on the existing trail shows a monthly average of 32,281 bicycle and pedestrian trips. Your own surveys indicate that people who bicycle and people who want to bicycle but are scared of motorists want to be separated from traffic by more than a painted white line on the pavement. Motorists who are speeding, impaired, on their phones, and are driving monster vehicles with hoods resembling battering rams put bicyclists and pedestrians at risk. The latest bicycle versus vehicle tragedy in our county occurred July 23rd on South Higuera in San Luis Obispo when a hit-and-run driver sideswiped one bicyclist and hit another. One cyclist, Saul Goldberg, died from his injuries, and the other cyclist, Martin Suits, is recovering. Ironically, the city of San Luis Obispo received a state grant and other funding, including $1.6 million from SLOCOG, to install complete street improvements on South Higuera between Marsh Street and Los Osos Valley Road to improve safety for bicyclists and pedestrians. These improvements are in the final design stage and are set for construction next year. Would those improvements have saved this, prevented this crash from happening? I mean, we'll never know that, but I think it would have, it could have. We are so close to completing the Bob Jones Trail, which will separate bicyclists and pedestrians from vehicle traffic and bypass six on and off ramps, including the intersection of Ontario Road at South Higuera, where southbound motorists are accelerating to highway speeds. The last thing I want you to know is that Saul Goldberg, the cyclist who was killed, was a volunteer on the Bob Jones Trail. He created the interpretive markers that you have all enjoyed, I'm sure. So this is a huge loss to our entire community. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Ellison, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. I'm Rick Ellison, Executive Director of Bike Slow County, a countywide nonprofit whose mission is to inspire, educate, advocate, and work to build a safe, healthy, and connected community through bicycling. The Bob Jones Trail is the perfect example of how our mission is fulfilled. The Bob Jones Trail extension from Avalette to the Octagon Barn will be the single highest used multi-use class 4 bikeway in the county. As just mentioned, more than 32,000 bicyclists and pedestrians every month, as well as extrapolate that to over a year, and it's hundreds of thousands of users on that trail. And when that extension is built, it will even multiply greater. There's another issue here that I want, that I believe Rich mentioned in the report, is that we're all aware that California is facing a severe budget deficit. And the county, SLOCOG, were the gracious beneficiaries of the $18 million initial grant. That was in an era when there was more than $1 billion in state funding that went toward projects through the Active Transportation Program. That is gone. By recent reports that I have heard, the state budget has an allocation of $200 million for the Active Transportation Program. Again, it was last cycle, it was more than $1 billion. There may be an additional appropriation, but at currently the base budget. So I encourage you to approve the staff recommendation so that we can fulfill and see the dream of the Bob Jones Trail, which has been a dream for more than 20 years and will be an asset to this community far and wide, not just in the South County, but from the North County, individuals who come down to the Bob Jones Trail area, as well as further south individuals. So please approve the SLOCOG staff recommendation of the additional $7 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last speaker is Eric Greening. If anybody else has a comment, please let me know now.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I also very much approve of the Bob Jones Trail. And I hope that in October, the North County package will include some progress forward steps on the Atascadero-Templeton connector. Relative to the Bob Jones Trail, it may be of interest to board members and SLOCOG staff to want to attend the supervisors' afternoon session next Tuesday, the 20th, when the resolution for necessity, a key increment in this project, is on the agenda. Again, that's 1:30 in this chamber, action required by the Board of Supervisors. I know there is some hesitancy. Private property rights are very important, but I continue to urge that exactly the same standard of necessity should be given to a non-motorized transportation project as to a road. Both roads and non-motorized infrastructure can be used for essential purposes and they can be used for recreation. A lot of recreational use happens on our roads. We call it tourism and we encourage it. We go out of our way to accommodate it. And so again, I very much hope, I hope that all of the county supervisors hear the interest from members of the board, members of the public, members of the SLOCAD staff in moving this project forward next Tuesday the 20th at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, I'll bring it back to the board for any comments or deliberation on this item. Is Ortiz Leg, is that a comment or a motion?
I'd be happy to make a motion, but I will preface it with comment. And that is that I appreciate staff's report and to continually work on this board to develop the regionalism that this board is about. And I think that, as Rich said, it was a very centric and South County heavy agenda in regards to the expenditures. However, we look forward to doing the same for the North County. I think what's really important here is that we are at a moment where so many things have been put together. All the pieces of the puzzle are starting to really come together. And I think that, once we get some things done here, we can move off and start working in the other regions to do the kinds of exciting things that were talked about earlier up in North County, et cetera. So I just, we're anxious to have more safe and enjoyable travel for both workforce as well as the tourists. And I think with the Shell Beach addition to this, it really adds a wonderful economic and healthier lifestyle opportunity. And though I encourage my colleagues to look at that big picture and, aligning with our broader regional goals, all of that. So I just wanted to put my plug in for these projects. And I knowing that everybody's worked really hard to put all the monies together, the funding, and then, get this completed and then start focusing on the other areas of our county that solely need the same kind of approach. So I am going to go ahead and make a motion is the word I'm looking for, a motion of support for this item.
Great. Second.
And the second, Mr. Strong. Okay, and additional comments?
I just want to mention Waggy, that then the City of Pismo, we did send a letter in support of the Bob Jones Trail, and I appreciate, too, Rich mentioned that the city's also contributing $850,000 toward the Shell Beach portion of the multi-use path. Thank you.
Perfect. Appreciate hearing that. Ms. Arnold.
And I will just say I won't be supporting the motion. It's no surprise. I have been preaching, I guess you can almost say at this point. I still believe that the private property rights is aspect of private property rights is a core to our society, our constitution, et cetera, et cetera. And historically, I have supported the Bob Jones Trail, but as now it's expanded at its last stages into the use of what we're, I guess, now calling resolution of necessity. I'm still calling it eminent domain, seizure of private property against the property owner's will. And I think we're getting into dangerous territory. I believe in the good of the public. I believe in working towards these things, but I still think that we're that this use of eminent domain, especially when we've known all along as the project continued to be designed, knowing it was going to hit this wall of unwilling sellers, we just kept going. So for me to continue to support that path, no pun intended, I am going to not be voting for this motion.
All right, thank you. And my comments, I do appreciate the accommodation in the kind of in the policy statement in terms of support for Prado Road for the next funding cycle. And frankly, if we can't build our overpass right now, I'm delighted that the funding is going to go towards the Shell Beach shared use path and please, oh, please, the Bob Jones Trail. I think it's going to be amazing projects, and the connectivity that we're seeing within the city and throughout the county is just really exciting for all modes of travel. So I'm looking forward to supporting that. And seeing no further comments, Ida, could we have roll call, please?
Board Member Ortiz Legg?
Yes.
Board Member Strong?
Yes.
Board Member Arnold?
No.
Board Member Gibson?
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie?
Yes.
Board Member Moreno?
Yes.
Board Member Rushing?
Yes.
Board Member Waggy?
Yes.
Board Member Wixom?
Yes.
Vice President Paulding?
Yes.
President Pease?
Yes.
The motion carried.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we'll go on to our final action item for today, which is the final 2025 Federal Transportation Improvement Program. We have John DeNunzio.
Good morning, Chair Pease and SLOCOG Board. John DeNunzio, SLOCOG staff, here to present the final Federal Transportation Improvement Program 2025 version. The FTIP is a required four-year document. We update this document every 2 years. It includes the federally funded and the regionally significant projects. They're grouped together by year. It is consistent with the regional transportation plan and is fiscally constrained. So there is a balance sheet in the center with revenues versus programmed monies. Projects must be in the FTIP in order to receive the federal, the E76, that our project managers require to release those funds. And it also includes performance measures required by the feds. Ours also includes the air quality conformity analysis. So we began collaboration and input into the 2025 plan 4 months ago in April. The engagement consisted of the local agencies as well as Caltrans and the RTA. In May, we held advisory committee meetings with members and opened this a 30-day public comment period, which we held from June 12th through July 12th over the summer. And then in mid-July, we also met with the interagency consultation team, which includes the Air Pollution Control District and the EPA, to review these project impacts with East County and our air quality non-attainment zone. And so today we're adopting the final FTIP, and then we will submit this to the Caltrans Division of Financial Programming by the end of the month. Here's just a few bullet points of the features and highlights of the plan. Again, these are fiscal year constrained 24-25 through 27-28. It includes group listings of approximately 100 projects of transportation projects. And for the first time in this plan, we're grouping all of our projects into lists. And the individual projects can be still seen through our website at slocog.org. As mentioned, the federal, state, and local funding totals approximately $630 million in a four-year cycle. And $40 million of that is included in the Transit POP, the Program of Projects, which is the federal 5307 money and other federal transit funds. This also includes the air quality conformity analysis and then the updates that we had from the public and our stakeholders between the draft and the final. We made sure that we got those in there. There is an additional board resolution, so this will have two board resolutions. The second one is assigning a delegated authority to the executive director so that we can process future administrative modifications ourselves. So this will provide an efficiency in streamlining our FTIP amendments So the next time you see me with the FTIP, it might not be for another 2 years. So when we adopt the next one. So we should be able to handle all those administratively through the executive director's delegation and streamlining process. And you'll see that reflected in the second staff recommendation here. So our first recommendation is to adopt this resolution approving the 2025 FTIP and the corresponding air quality conformity analysis and determination, as well as adopt a resolution adopting a delegation of approval of administrative modifications to the FTIP and FSTIP to the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments Executive Director. And then if there's any additional technical corrections that come out of today that we, you know, when we submit this to Caltrans, we make sure we get everything that needs to be in there before we send it off. And that concludes. We've had support from both our technical advisory committees for this and are asking for your support too.
Great, thank you. You've had lots of opportunities to talk about this one, but questions for staff?
No question. I was going to.
Do you have a question?
I just have a comment.
Comment? Go for it.
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation, all the hard work that went into the staff report. Just wanted to remind the board and staff that we do, in some cases, have a challenge in becoming eligible for certain federal funding sources like the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill or the Inflation Reduction Act because they prioritize disadvantaged communities. And per our California state definition of a DAC, which often relies on the Cal Enviro Screen tool, a number of our communities that are otherwise defined as DACs in our SLOCOG methodology are not with that California tool and with some of the federal tools. And so the more that our staff and our lobbyists can continue to prioritize that issue with our state and federal legislators, the better we will be in terms of, better positioned we will be in terms of being eligible for those funding sources. So just wanted to, again, restate that that's a priority of mine and I think a priority of this board as we talk about leveraging federal funds. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. And I don't have any public comments at this time, so I'll go ahead and entertain a motion. Mr. Strong.
And I was going to move the staff's recommendation, approval of the staff recommendation.
Thank you.
Ed Waggy, second.
Terrific. So we have a motion and a second and no further comments. Roll call, please.
Board Member Strong.
Aye.
Board Member Waggy.
Yes.
Board Member Arnold.
Yes.
Board Member Gibson.
Yes.
Board Member Guthrie.
Yes.
Board Member Moreno.
Yes.
Board Member Ortiz Legg.
Yes.
Board Member Rushing.
Yes.
Board Member Wixom.
Yes.
Vice President Paulding.
Yes.
President Pease.
Yes.
The motion passed.
Terrific. So we'll that was the last of our action items. We'll do board member comments. And as a reminder, we are not having closed session.
Up for closed session, just for public comment, because it's on the agenda.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so let's go ahead and do board member comments, and then we'll do the update about the closed session. Thank you. Any board member liaison reports? I guess the one that I would have is just that I was able to participate in that press conference with Salud Carbajal, and it was great to be able to thank him, and I appreciate Jeff Straw and team and Rich Murphy to be able to provide support for that opportunities to share some of the great funding that we've been able to receive. So thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. So closed session.
Just take public comment.
Okay, terrific. So we do have the closed session item for Executive Director's annual performance evaluation. The actual evaluation will happen next month, but if there's anyone here that would like to speak on that item, you have that opportunity now. All right, seeing none, we'll close that. And
Chair, I just have a question. So currently, I think we were only having an RTA meeting next month. So will we then adjourn to a closed session for SLOCOG, and that will be the only item on the agenda, or will there be other SLOCOG business in September on the 4th?
We had no intention to bring SLOCOG business, but with this continuance, well, that'll be the only agenda.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification. Appreciate that. Okay. And with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn this SLOCOG board meeting. We'll give ourselves just a couple minutes to reset for RTA Executive Committee for folks who are sticking around for that. Thanks, everyone.